Okay, so I want to talk about, just to start off today, if you read the email they went out on Friday, you might be wondering what kind of thing is going to happen today. So, but I think that's good, right? Because now you're here, so it worked. Anyway, I'm going to start talking about a guy who I think is probably one of the most interesting figures of the 20th century. He wasn't a political figure or someone of like real great power or anything like that, but he stands among very few in terms of his sort of influence over really how we understand the arts in general, but also our connection to media nowadays. This guy was in his mid-20s. He managed to write, direct, produce, and star in what's still regarded as probably the greatest American film of all time. Through that, he managed to completely reshape cultural history's memory of a major media mogul of the time. And most important to what I want to talk about today, he managed to convince most of America that they were under attack by aliens one night in the late 1930s. So, if you know your 20th century history, you may know that I'm talking about Orson Welles. You can put up that picture. This is just so you can see what he looks like. It's not important, but the movie that I was talking about is a movie called Citizen Kane. The mogul was a guy named William Randolph Hearst, who, if you've never heard of him, you can probably thank Orson Welles. And the radio show I was talking about was an adaptation of another Welles story, H.G. Welles' The War of the Worlds. So now I'm just going to talk a little bit about Orson Welles, just because he's so fascinating, but I'm not even going to touch on half of his life. He was born into an affluent family in a small Wisconsin city called Kenosha, and was almost immediately pronounced a genius as a very young boy. There's newspaper articles about him as a child talking to adults in diners about Shakespeare and current affairs and all sorts of stuff like that. Both of his parents died when he was still a teenager, and so he decided that instead of taking the inheritance he got and going to he had a scholarship to Harvard, he decided he wasn't going to do that. He went off to Europe and traveled around Ireland trying to sell paintings that he was painting up. He's trying to sell these out of like a donkey cart. I guess that didn't work out too well for him. So one day he walked into one of the major theaters in Dublin and said that he was a Broadway star and that he, you know, wanted to audition for some shows. And I guess he must have been a pretty good actor because he got a job. And so he made his debut there in 1931 when he was just 16 years old, by the way. And he worked there for a few years before he came back to America. Where he published a series of books. He's still a teenager, by the way, on Shakespeare, which were very popular. And by 1933, he was acting on Broadway. And by 1935, when he was 20, he was a producer of his own production company called the Mercury Theater. And the theater was immensely popular because what they would do is adapt Shakespeare in classic plays. Two of the more notable ones, he adapted Macbeth and set it in Haiti. With an all-black cast, and then the other one was he adapted Julius Caesar and moved it from the Roman Empire to fascist Italy at the time, like in the 1930s, and basically became the toast of Broadway. His adaptations are still regarded as probably among the best Shakespeare adaptations that have ever been done. While he was doing this, he was also on the radio. If you've ever heard Orson Welles speak, he's got this great, great voice. And so he's doing radio shows, and eventually the Columbia Broadcasting System, which is CBS, you know, today, gave him his own show called the Mercury Theater on the Air. And so that's important because one night in October 1938, Welles decided that he was going to put on a Halloween special, and he decided he was going to adapt H.G. Welles' War of the Worlds. But he wasn't just going to tell it as a straight story, because that wouldn't be sensational enough for a guy like Welles. So he decided that he was going to take the story, move it from England, which is where the original story is set, move it to the east coast of the United States, New Jersey and New York. And as I said, rather than tell it as a story, he decided he was going to tell it through a series of newscasts, interrupting different things. Now, at the time, radio was pretty new still. and you had this war brewing in Europe. And so people were very used to their favorite shows being interrupted all the time by news announcements. So Wells kind of exploited this in the show, which this is a recording of. This is a record album, for those of you too young to remember. He basically introduces it and then makes up this thing about basically you're just listening to a music show. And then he kind of interrupts and he says, oh, there's this announcer comes on and says there's this weird thing happening on Mars, these atmospheric disturbances, but it's no big deal. And they go back to the music, and then there's word of a meteor landing, and they interview somebody. And this goes on for about 12 minutes of just sort of not, like, these announcements coming in, but they don't really make sense, and you're listening to big bands and things like that. But in about 12 minutes, because he knew that his main competitor on another station, on NBC, liked to take a break around 12 minutes, there's this guy named Eddie Bergen, who is a radio ventriloquist. I'm not quite sure the appeal of a ventriloquist on the radio, but he was very popular. But he took a break around 12 minutes, and so Wells decided that that was the point where he was going, because he knew that people channel surfed back then too, even before remote controls. So that was the point where he was going to land his aliens. And so he has this announcement where there's been this meteor landed in a field in New Jersey. And right around the time, all of a sudden, this thing starts opening up. Nobody knows what's going on. And it just, this heat ray, as they call it, just wipes out the entire army that had been sort of lined up around there. And so if you had been tuning in, just tuning in, it all sounds actually quite realistic if you ever listen to it. And you would think, this is strange. So for the next half hour, the reports just keep getting worse and worse, and these aliens, if you know the story of the War of the Worlds, they have these tripod alien spaceship things, and they make their way across the United States, and they're wiping out, there's all these reports of different cities being leveled, and the army being called in and being helpless against these aliens, about 40 minutes into the broadcast. There's been no stop in the story. There's been no, like, this is, you're listening to CBS or the Orson Welles or anything like that. It ends with this reporter reporting from the top of the CBS building in New York, talking about these aliens coming across the Hudson River, people in New York running into the East River on the other side of the island, and this toxic gas floating in and buildings being leveled, until basically the reporter, too, drops dead. And then you get 30 seconds of dead air, which if you've ever listened to the radio for 30 seconds of dead air, seems like an eternity, but Wells wouldn't let them cut it off. We're basically, if you were listening to the radio and you thought this was real, you probably thought you were alone in the world at this point. And after this 30 seconds, finally this very stern sounding announcer says, you know, by the way, you're listening to the Mercury Theater on the air, Orson Welles. It's just a show, right? And then for the rest of the show, it kind of carries on more normally. But I don't know if people stopped listening when that 30 seconds hit, turned off their radio and ran outside, because this thing caused pandemonium in the States. There's all sorts of stories. That's why I brought this, not just to show off a record, but there's all these reports here on the back. This is from the Associated Press Newswire. So I'm just going to read a couple, just so you get a feel for what was going on. Pittsburgh. A man returned home in the midst of this broadcast and found his wife, a bottle of poison in her hand, screaming, I'd rather die than this way than like that. Indianapolis. A woman ran into a church screaming, New York is destroyed. It's the end of the world. You might as well go home and die. I just heard it on the radio. Services were dismissed immediately. Braverd, North Carolina. 5 Braverd college students fainted and panic gripped the campus for half an hour, with many students fighting for telephones to inform their parents to come and pick them up. Providence, Rhode Island. Weeping and hysterical women swamped the switchboard of the Providence Journal for details of the massacre. The electric company received scores of calls urging them to turn off all the lights so that the city would be safe from the enemy. I guess aliens can't see in the dark. I can't remember if there's any other interesting ones. Anyway, there's lots of that. And go to that next slide. Here's the front page of the New York Times the next day. Okay, so you can see right there, front and center, radio listeners panic, taking war drama as fact. This is amongst news of the war in Europe and different things like that. It's a huge, huge deal. Go to the next one. This is from the Winnipeg Free Press, October 31st, right there in the corner. So again, you see war in Europe, real things, right there, hysteria, grips. So this was huge news. Completely wrapped this audience in the States at the time. Go to the next one. This one's just kind of interesting. It says here, no panic here over broadcast. So this is just nice for us Winnipeggers. Apparently none of our ancestors bought it. They were like, this is not real. They just listened to it right at the show. Also interesting, Winnipeg used to win football games. So that's nice too. I guess that would have been funnier if we hadn't won on Friday. Yeah, maybe that's made up too. That's high-end stuff there. You don't have to keep this picture up anymore. It's okay. As I said, this is big news. Actually, in the weeks that followed, over 12,000 newspaper stories were written about this hoax and some of the things that happened. Also, the story was picked up. One person who was particularly fond of this story was Adolf Hitler, who pointed out, who used Mr. Wells' broadcast to point out the feeble-minded nature of Americans and how easy they would be to defeat. He also blamed the hysteria on the weakness of democracy as a political system. I suppose he thought fascists were less susceptible to being duped, but I don't know how that explains World War II. But anyway. So what's really fascinating about this whole thing, the reason I'm talking about it, is because I want to touch on this idea of narrative, reality, the reality of narrative and perception of that reality. Because what Wells was able to do for a large portion of people is completely shift reality for them, completely shift the narrative of reality, at least for a little while, by manipulating just their perception of it. For people who were listening to the radio that night, the perception of the events was built on the fact that news was fair, straightforward, and presented in earnest. Basically, that news was trustworthy. So Wells exploited this perception in order to spook his audience. Whether or not Wells knew that, all the pandemonium, or he would cause this sort of pandemonium, is up for debate. There are also reports that he was told during the broadcast that these things were going on. People were calling in saying, you know, interrupt the thing and tell people that this is just a show. And Wells, being Wells, wouldn't have it. I mean, he's 24 years old, right? He's not going to care too much. The next day, there's this newsreel footage of him looking very contrite and shocked over what's happened, and he's saying, we had no idea that this would have happened. Obviously, we would have interrupted it, but probably not the case. He knew all along. But anyway, from this, just interestingly, things worked out pretty well for Wells in the immediate aftermath. Instead of being thrown in prison or something like that, which was what the newspapers were calling for, he ended up getting a sponsor for his radio show, so it became the Campbell Soup Playhouse after that. And shortly after, RKO Studios in Hollywood offered him a contract that gave him complete creative control, which nobody had ever gotten, except maybe Charlie Chaplin. But they gave it to this 24-year-old kid. From that, he made Citizen Kane, which I mentioned before. Citizen Kane is another movie where he stretches the bounds of reality and understanding of the narrative of reality. He even messes with using newsreel footage again in there to craft the life of this media mogul, which was based on this guy, William Randolph Hearst, who Wells thought would be a pushover, but Hearst ended up actually ruining Wells' career, got him blacklisted in Hollywood, all sorts of stuff. So he didn't turn out so well after that one. But interestingly, you can't think of Hearst nowadays. If you know about Hearst or Citizen Kane, the two are linked. And everybody kind of assumes Citizen Kane is Hearst's life story, which it's not. But I guess Wells kind of got one out in the end on that one. But anyway, we're going to leave Wells for now, just for a bit. If you are interested in him, there's literally volumes written on him. But what I really want to talk about is this idea of narrative and reality being shaped by perception. So each of us are writing a narrative all the time, whether we sort of are aware of it or not. Our lives are a narrative. And some of us let that narrative be shaped by others, and we just sort of drift through life. Others of us are very deliberate about the sort of story that our life will tell one day. Probably most of us are in between somewhere, trying to just figure out life day to day. But yeah, it's interesting the way that our own stories look to us as opposed to other people. So what might seem like a mistake in somebody's life to me could be a very deliberate action to make a change that will help later on. What appears to be drifting may in fact be taking time to actually figure out where a person wants to go. And what might look like a failed relationship or a marriage may in fact be a catalyst for someone that someone needed to make the leap from just an average person to maybe an extraordinary person. The point is that we humans are extremely short-sighted when it comes to judging the sort of arc of narrative. We perceive the present, and we jump immediately to what we see as the imminent conclusion. So a newscast proclaims that Martians have landed, and we believe that it's the end of the world. The perfect example of this happens every day, if you're paying any attention to the election in the South. You get poll numbers come in, and people go, well, this is what it's going to be. You know, it changes by 0.5%, and suddenly whoever's going to be president changes day to day, hour to hour sometimes. So we like to jump on our immediate news to form a conclusion. And we may look back on the people of 1938 and think and laugh at their gullibility and say that that sort of thing couldn't really happen now. Yet, at least a few times a year, there's some celebrity that's pronounced dead. And more than a few Twitter feeds are filled with condolences, including sometimes Twitter feeds of respected news organizations, which is always funny. Now, in regards to, again, going back to War of the Worlds and this idea of narrative, there's actually, the story that I told you, there's quite a bit of debate even around that, around the hysteria that was reported in the newspapers. And some people believe that the story of the hysteria is as much a hoax as the story of the Martians. Because aside from a few anecdotes and a few unsubstantiated claims, there really are very few documents of the sort of panic that was reported. Some historians say this is simply due to the fact that the incidents happened too quickly. I mean, if you think if it happened in maybe an hour, 40 minutes to an hour, you can't really get... back then, you couldn't get a news crew up, right? You had to get a camera and film and everything else. So it happened too quickly to be documented. But other claims are that the newspapers, seeing a chance to sort of discredit this new media of radio, which they saw as a threat, trumped up tons and tons of stories so that they could always say, well, you need us newspapers because you can't trust the radio. They're just they're just a bunch of pranksters over there. And so we have this history in news of something that maybe was very small, but looks huge. And so that starts to change your perception of that historical reality. Suddenly it's not one authoritative story. It's four or five competing stories that all have their own kind of angle on the truth. But then the reality of it is based on your perception of which one of these stories you want to believe. So you can believe that the United States went insane one night in 1938, or you can believe that a lot of people listened to a nice little radio show and one or two people might have called in to say, hey, this is pretty realistic. Is this actually going on? If you were to this woman who took the with the poison, if she in fact even existed is a question, if she had succeeded in killing herself, she would have died with the understanding that the rest of the world would soon be joining her in the afterlife. Her understanding of reality was a long way from what was happening, but it was based solely on her perception. And so, thinking about that idea, perception and reality, I want to touch on a narrative that maybe is more familiar to all of us, and that's Christ's crucifixion. And so I want to read just a portion of that, and let's just think about, try and forget everything else you know about the story, and just listen to this and think about being in this position. So this is from Luke 24. By this time it was noon, and darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. The light from the sun was gone, and suddenly the thick veil hanging in the temple was torn apart. Then Jesus shouted, Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands. And with those words, he breathed his last. When the captain of the Roman soldiers handling the execution saw what had happened, he praised God and said, "Surely this man was innocent." And when the crowd that had come to see the crucifixion saw all that had happened, they went away in deep sorrow. But Jesus' friends, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance and watched. So now, if that was the only part of the story you knew, or if you imagined being there at that moment with Jesus' followers, suddenly the arc of this sacrifice and this narrative that Jesus had been crafting and that has been crafted, you know, ever since, becomes a lot less upbeat, to say the least. So, you know, so imagine being one of those followers. What was the reality of this situation as they perceived it? This man, who they had spent 3 years following, learning from, and watching perform these incredible miracles, had just been beaten, humiliated, mocked, and killed right before their eyes. Chances are the story seemed like it was probably over. Jesus had failed. He was not the Christ, and apparently he was just another nut from the desert making promises he couldn't keep. A few days later, things were looking a little more positive. Jesus showed up again, you know, so that's something. But then, and I'm sure there was a lot, you know, the story shifted again. But then you think about a month later, he left. And we think about how short our memories are. It's not hard to imagine that, again, many of those followers felt like they were on the wrong side of history here. In fact, despite the burgeoning growth of the early church, most of those followers died not understanding the full arc of the narrative that they were an integral part of. And chances are we as well will die one day not knowing the full arc of the story because it's not finished yet. But the immediate reality of Christ's story is one of failure. He left the earth without accomplishing a whole lot when you talk about numbers, or if you want to get into numbers. But, I mean, he was in a small region of the Roman Empire that didn't have a lot of influence, and he left mostly unnoticed. And, you know, so you could say he didn't really accomplish much. But yet his narrative has stretched on so far past him, or so far past the time he spent on earth, because a group of people had a different perception of the events of his life. For the last 2,000 years, there have been those who've carried Jesus' story forward. In the early days, you had people like the apostles, Paul, John. Later on, you had people like St. Augustine. Even later, further, you had other, you know, they call them defenders of the faith or whatever. People like Joan of Arc, Martin Luther, William Wilberforce, even Abraham Lincoln, Nellie McClung, Martin Luther King. These were men and women who didn't view the sort of hushed tones of Christ's revolution as a failure, but as a perfect way to affect the course of history. And these were people that affected great social change by accepting the role of the underdog, of the failure. Christ's death on the cross was the ultimate failure for anyone engaged in the immediate perception of the narrative he was crafting. The reality to those standing at the foot of the cross was that the story was over. Yet for those of us who know Christ's work, the work had barely even begun at that point. And so there's this passage in 2 Corinthians, I think, which sort of sums up our position in terms of, in relation to sort of that narrative, as well as our narrative and the narrative of history. So this is from 2 Corinthians 4. It says, "That is why we never give up. Though our bodies are dying, our spirits are being renewed every day. For our present troubles are quite small and won't last very long. Yet they produce for us an immeasurably great glory that will last forever. So we don't look at the troubles we can see right now. Rather, we look forward to what we have not yet seen. For the troubles we see will soon be over, but the joys to come will last forever." And so there it is, this idea saying, don't hang on to the reality, immediate perception of your reality, but continue to think about the arc of your narrative as it goes. I think it would probably be easy for each of us to remember something we could call invasions, maybe, from Martians in our own lives. Moments when it seemed like the Martians had landed in reality, and the reality was that the world was coming to an end. Perhaps you can think back and laugh at those moments now. But perhaps you haven't moved far enough down the road yet to see those moments as anything but tragedies or failures. For some people, failures stay that. They never move beyond them. And the narrative of their lives become defined by the invasion rather than the triumph. By the way, at the end of the story, humans beat the Martians. I won't ruin it for you. just as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about my grandfather on my father's side, who I never met. He died before I was born. But one time I was having a conversation with my Aunt Shirley, and she's sort of the archivist of my family. She keeps the family tree and pictures and letters and journals and all sorts of stuff. And she was telling me about this failure that he had had in his life when he was a young man, and how he never really got over it. And in fact, it shaped the rest of his life in terms of careers that he chose and things that he went after in life. He never sort of got over this one failure as a young man. And when I think back on my own life too, I struggle with particular failures that still haunt me and that I still can't view as just minor invasions, but that still kind of shaped my narrative as I see it at this point. But I'm learning that a heavy heart is no reason to lose faith, and that a resurrection can't happen to people who don't die. That one who doesn't suffer cannot be comforted. There's this, I feel like I talk about this guy a lot, but Leonard Cohen has this great line in one of his songs where he says, "Oh, bless the continuous stutter of the word being made into flesh." And this is us. We are the great experiment to see if the word, the tenets, the principles, the ideas, and most importantly, the hope of Christ's message can be personified. Stuttering is a rather polite metaphor for the process that most of us go through to achieve that sort of metamorphosis, but I think it works. The reality is that life is fraught with failure. Our narratives are rank with missteps and mistakes, and it's easy to be bogged down by the endless string of alien invasions. It's easy to submit to the end of the world. But is that, the question I keep asking myself, is that the way that I want my narrative to be perceived? Is that the way you want your narrative to be perceived? And so I began talking about Orson Welles, and so I'm going to give him the last word again, because he crafts his words so much better than I do anyway. This is a much older Orson Welles that we're going to see in this clip. Sort of actually pretty close to the end of his life. This is from the last movie he ever finished. He left about a dozen movies unfinished. But he's sort of musing as he wanders around the Chartres Cathedral, which is in France, and is usually regarded as one of the highest regarded of all the European cathedrals. I think this is pertinent to what we've been talking about because it reminds us of how our perception of ourselves can shift in the consideration of the personal versus the communal, the micro versus the macro, the banal versus the transcendent, and most importantly, the temporal versus the eternal.